The Taliban say the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan after 20 years is a victory for the Afghans and a lesson for the invaders. At least 7 Taliban members are killed and several others are wounded in clashes with militia fighters in Panjshir Valley north of capital Kabul. EU chief Ursula von der Leyen says 70% of adults in the bloc have been inoculated against COVID-19, but she's warning the pandemic is not over yet. This is World News from our Tehran studios. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The Taliban have celebrated the U.S. Full withdrawal from Afghanistan after a last batch of troops left early on Tuesday. Now, that pullout marks the end of a 20-year war that brought Afghanistan nothing but destruction. Now, political analyst Wilmer Leon says the departure of American forces from Afghanistan does not mean Washington would stop its interventionist policy there.
The 31st of August is significant for the people of Afghanistan. It is significant for people in Pakistan and other countries in the region. It is incredibly significant for the United States because it does bring an end to this 20-year fiasco. Unfortunately for the people of the United States, it doesn't seem to bring an end to the desire to continue to pump billions of dollars into the United States military, as is being reported now that Republicans are trying to add another $25 billion to the already $753 billion National Defense Authorization Act. So the money laundering scheme that I call the 20-year fiasco in Afghanistan, because the only people that really benefited from this were U.S. arms manufacturers, such as Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the others, they're going to continue, or at least the Republicans are continuing trying their best to pump more money into them. But it does finally bring an end to this fiasco. And the other unfortunate thing, I don't think it does, it doesn't bring an end to the interventionist, imperialist American foreign policy. The mindset here, unfortunately, is still the same. The decision makers, the policy makers, have not really seemed to learn anything from this, but it does bring an end to this fiasco.
A political analyst, John Stepling, says the U.S. justification for invading Afghanistan is an utter lie.
You have to put all of this into a 20-year perspective, right? The original justification for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was a lie from the beginning, and everybody knows that. Then there was a great deal of rhetoric about women's rights and freedom for the Afghan people and so forth and so on. The United States spent hundreds of trillions of dollars in Afghanistan. They are leaving behind massive amounts of military equipment that the Taliban will probably be able to use, repair, refurbish, and use. They left a lot of it right at the airport, in fact. But all this rhetoric from the U.S., remember, too, that military contractors outnumber military personnel from 2017 on. And, in fact, more, private military contractors died in Afghanistan than did U.S. military personnel. Of course, more Afghans died than anyone else. And just the other day, Biden had a drone attack that wiped out an entire family. Nobody seems to care anything about this when they are indulging this rhetoric about human rights and women's rights and so forth.
Okay, now let's go to London. Our correspondent, Ahmed Caballo, is there. Ahmed, let us know where you are exactly and what's going on there.
Okay, so we're outside of the Houses of Parliament, and today is obviously a significant day because it marks the end, the deadline agreed between the US and the Taliban for foreign occupation troops to leave Afghanistan. Now, despite trillions of dollars used to prop up the Afghan government since 2001, it has been an epic failure for the occupation forces. That is because the government that they popped up was consistently ranked as one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. Successive governments, the army, the government, lacked legitimacy. And this was signaled by the fact that the former Afghan president left the country when the Taliban took over Kabul with $170 million in his airplane on his flight to United Arab Emirates. Now, to discuss this, I've got with me Mohsen Abbas, who's going to get into what this means for Afghanistan and what this also means for the United States and the United Kingdom's special relationship.
Okay.
Now, Mohsen, since the deadline has been reached, there's been many comments made by Joe Biden and by Boris Johnson to try save face. Boris Johnson recently said that to the family of British troops that they have not died in vain. What do you think about the many soldiers from the United States and the United Kingdom that died in Afghanistan? Did they die in vain? Did the US and the UK achieve their objectives?
I think the whole policy of what I call Anglo-Zionist imperialism has been an absolute disaster in Afghanistan. Quite frankly, not only in financial terms, but in terms of human lives and virtually every other measure that you'd like to gauge success or failure by. Let's start with the financial side of it. First of all, you have approximately $2.5 trillion of US taxpayers' money that was pumped into this doomed venture. They have accrued debts, because they have borrowing on that, which will go on till 2050 and could accumulate something like $6.5 trillion of interest payments alone. Imagine the impact on the average US citizen just of that payment. Not only that, they've squandered at least $85 billion of that on supposedly training an Afghan army, which was meant to provide stability, which collapsed within a matter of days. So that in itself shows the monumental failure. Move on to lives. As far as the lives concerned, well, 2,500 plus US personnel, military personnel, dead. On top of that, you've got the contractors, the private American contractors. Over 3,500 of those have died. But really, where the real casualties are very sad and very frustrating for anybody who has a humanitarian sense of conscience is the civilians, the Afghan civilians, of which there are conservative figures of hundreds of thousands, but it could be a lot more. Of course, these figures can be, they can be gerrymandered. The Taliban, 50 or 60,000 soldiers, military personnel from their side have died. But also, don't forget the 70 or so thousand Afghan soldiers, for the government soldiers that have died. So it's been an absolute disaster. The displacement of people, the poverty that exists in Afghanistan now, bears testimony to the absolute woeful failure of the entire mission. You've got, I say it's about 500,000 Afghans who've been displaced just in the last month or so. Before that, the UN has told us quite clearly that half the population is living under the poverty level. In fact, half of them are in need of aid, humanitarian aid of one form or another. So add all that up, and on top, look at the benefits for either the American people or the world. There are none. They didn't have an enemy in Afghanistan to deal with. It was one man, Bin Laden, who was also on their own payroll, off the record, and that's the real sadness of the whole Afghan situation. That they went in there for no reason. They were often at loggerheads between, say, the CIA and the actual military itself and the government. They had parallel policies that have been going on even to this day, even in the latest deaths in Kabul airport. It's now claimed that actually it's CIA operatives who were shooting at individuals who'd been shot, who'd already been blown up by CIA-backed ISIS-K. So there are huge questions to be asked about the American administration in terms of the CIA, the Pentagon, US State Department, as to what really was going on in Afghanistan. What was the real purpose of being there? Because quite frankly, it's something which beggars belief in terms of the disaster that it's been all round.
And Joe Biden has tried to place the blame squarely on the Afghan people for what you've described as many US failures. What do you make of that? Are the Afghans responsible for the failure of the US, UK and NATO in Afghanistan?
Definitely not. I mean, the fact of the matter is the Americans went in there. What do you expect? If you're going to leave an area which you've effectively occupied, invaded, destroyed, done no real nation building, in fact handed over power to criminals and crooks, and haven't bothered to engage with the real people in Afghanistan in terms of giving them their real ability to rule the nation, then on top of that, to announce a withdrawal in the space that they did, in the time that they did, and in the manner that they did, smacks of either absolute incompetence or complicity in whatever has taken place. Now, there are lots of theories, and people all have their own theories which are legitimate, and we won't really know clearly what's actually gone on. But there are hugely suspicious moves in terms of the way that the Americans have pulled out, the way that the negotiations with the Taliban were done, the way that such a lightning blitzkrieg actually took over. How on earth can an Afghan military collapse within a few days, having been trained for 15 to 20 years, is quite frankly something that needs to be investigated very, very thoroughly, and questions need to be asked. So it's totally unfair to blame it on the Afghan people. They've been victims throughout this entire scenario. The 9/11 was the excuse to come in for the Americans. There was no involvement of Afghans in 9/11. It was the Saudi citizens that actually blew the Twin Towers up. Why on earth they ended up there with an operative that they'd been funding and financing and preparing is really primarily because at that time they wanted to prevent China and its Belt Road initiatives into the region. They wanted to keep Pakistan under pressure. They wanted an eastern front for the Islamic Republic of Iran, where they could go in and act as a stopper in that region. It's failed miserably. All of their policies have failed, and now what we're finding is that they are also arguably releasing a lot of their mercenaries, the ISIS, so-called ISIS Khorasan, which were imported in 2014 from the Iraqi and Syrian fronts, helicoptered in. Russian intelligence and Iranian intelligence have said this, that they are now propping up a mercenary outfit which is going to cause more chaos. And this is usually what they do. When they can't control a region directly, what they will do is they will leave behind all the situation which is going to create chaos, conflict and civil war. And that could be the actual thinking behind the way they left. That what they wanted was an absolute civil war, chaos and fighting, because they couldn't control it themselves. I mean, who's profited from all this? The contractors have, Boeing, the Lockheed Martins, the corporates, the transnational corporates. They've made trillions out of this, billions, multi-billions. On top of that, you've got the heroin trade or the opium trade, which was very, very lively during the American period. 90% of the world's opium was coming from Afghanistan while the Americans were occupying that land. So you can see that somebody has been profiting it. So while the US taxpayer is going to be giving all the money away, it seems that corporate military industrial complex America has been financing corporate outfits throughout the world during this period.
And what does this mean for the United States and the United Kingdom's so-called special relationship? They've had quite a public falling out over this withdrawal. Boris Johnson allegedly pleaded Joe Biden's administration not to leave August the 31st and to extend their deadline. And the US administration quite publicly ignored this plea. What do you think about the special relationship? Is it special at all? Or is it quite clearly the dog wagging the tail and the tail being United Kingdom in this situation?
I think the UK's been a junior partner, pretty insignificant junior partner, for a very long time. It's delusional of the British to think they're in some kind of special relationship and a partnership in the first place. The fact is, they're out on their tod with Brexit as it stands, so they need the Americans even more. But the Americans haven't really been giving the Brits any great favours. And in this incident, what you've seen is the debacle that actually they've been kept out of the entire American plan of how they were going to get move on.
Sorry, Mossim, we're going to have to leave this here. So you heard Mohsin Abbas's thoughts and analysis about the foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan and what it means for the United States and the United Kingdom's so-called special relationship. and what it means for their role in the region going forward. They call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires, and it appears that the United States might be the latest empire to fall as a result of a disastrous foreign invasion there. Back over to you in Tehran.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Kabbalah, our correspondent live for us in London. Now, at least 7 Taliban members have been killed and several more wounded in clashes with militia fighters in Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley north of the capital Kabul. Spokesman for National Resistance Forces, an anti-Taliban opposition group, said that a fighting occurred on the western entrance to the valley following a Taliban attack. He said that the raid may have been a probe to test the valley's defenses, but NRF fighters repulsed the Taliban assault. Ahmed Massoud, the son of the late anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, has established himself in the Panjshir Valley. He leads a force of several thousand made of militia and remnants of the army and special forces. Panjshir has been the only province to hold out against the Taliban following their takeover of Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia says that 8 people have been wounded in an attempted drone attack in the Abha International Airport. A civilian aircraft was also damaged in the incident in the south, Riyadh saying that the unmanned aerial vehicle was intercepted and shot down. The attack followed an earlier reported drone strike. No group has claimed responsibility yet. Different Saudi positions, including Abha Airport, have come under similar attacks in the past by the army in neighboring Yemen. Well, the Yemenis say that the strikes are retaliation for the Saudis' years-long war on their country. The president of the European Commission says the bloc has vaccinated 70% of its adult population, but she's warning that a pandemic is not over yet.
Today, we reached an important milestone in our vaccination campaign. 70% of adults in the European Union are now fully vaccinated, and that is more than 250 million people who are immunized. And this is a great achievement, which really shows what we can do when we work together. But the pandemic is not over, and we must remain vigilant. So first of all, we need many more Europeans.
Ursula von der Leyen also urged everyone to get their jabs, stressing that many more Europeans need to be vaccinated rapidly to avoid a new wave of infections and stop the emergence of new strains. The EU has secured over 620 million doses developed by American pharmaceutical company Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. The 27-member bloc has recorded more than 36 million COVID cases and over 750,000 related deaths. And that's a wrap for this news broadcast from Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 1-9395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A simple question.
The Ministry of Defence in central London has been busy since 2001. That's when the United Kingdom and America invaded Afghanistan to drive out Taliban forces. Some say this politically motivated escapade owed as much to gesture politics as it did to any military objective. After initial success in limiting the area of operations of the Taliban, the battle for hearts and minds began to be lost as the attempt to win through military power failed the West.
Britain has been closely involved with the campaign in Afghanistan. It is, in fact, just an example of similar initiatives involving Britain in Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. There is no sign that the British government will shift away from this militaristic approach as the UK struggles to adapt its international strategies in a new world order where it is not as powerful as it once was. All this war has damaged these countries in economic, social, and political ways. The public are deprived of health, housing, and safety. Businesses fail. Politicians compete to control anarchic and angry populations with the ever-present prospect of insurgency. Since the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has been key to much of this action, some argue NATO has served to destabilize the entire Middle East, while making Britain more of a target for enemies.
So what was the result of this and other military escapades in the Middle East and the surrounding region? Will the UK choose peaceful solutions in future? Or is the financial incentive just too great for the UK to give up on the arms industry? These are simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do people here in central London feel about the UK's military involvement in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Iraq? We put that to the public. Here's what they told us.
I don't think the British public know enough about what's going on there. I myself, I used to live in the Middle East. I know nothing about any kind of wars or any bad. I was an Emirate. I was in the Emirates, and I was an expat there, and I knew nothing but positivity and just so, I'm so accepted by the Emirati people, and yet we hear all this stuff about Iran and Iraq and all this Afghanistan, but what is actually happening? What is the problem? I don't feel like I know.
Well, to be honest, as a country, we've always got involved in everybody else's problems as a way to benefit this country, and it's about time they stop sticking their nose in.
I think UK should put more active participation. I don't think the country is doing enough in terms of global causes. So my view is that it should, being a superpower, it should rather be taking into account what's going around as well. Yeah. So that's, they might be doing it to a certain extent, but that's not enough with whatever is happening around. So.
Well, I'm born in Afghanistan, so I kind of was at first hand the situation there, my parents, how they had to flee, and we've obviously come over here to start a new life. I get it from a government point of view. We've got to take action. When there are regimes like the Taliban that unfortunately at the cost of civilians and normal people need to be addressed. They need to be challenged. But at the same time, in the last 20 years, the occupation, the alliance forces, how much good have they done? And now that they're leaving, what will that leave? What legacy will that leave? So I'm kind of, I don't know enough to kind of say one way or the other. I am skeptical, but also I appreciate the intervention is necessary because there are countries where, you know, leaders, dictators go on and on for decades. They don't take the country forward. So I appreciate the intervention, but I don't know if it was in the last 20 years.
Our involvement in all those wars has always been a disaster. I think we first invaded Afghanistan 200 years ago. There's never been anything in any of those wars that hasn't left a worse position. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people killed, and usually chaos. I was born in 1945. I grew up in that post-war world where we were told all our wars were about trying to create a democracy. They weren't. They're about getting control of oil in the Middle East and making money out of all of these things. We never created a democracy anywhere.
The 21st century has been a century of war for Britain. In fact, the last years of the 20th century were also in the era of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and the so-called Chicago Doctrine, the so-called right to protect, although they're highly discriminating in whom they intend to protect. And, of course, end up killing vast numbers of people in order to protect them, like the famous American general in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, who said we had to destroy that village in order to save it. It has been a colossal blunder, as well as a terrifically large crime. One of the great crimes of British history, and we have many crimes in British history, the invasion and occupation of first Afghanistan, then Iraq, the destruction of Libya, the attempt to destroy Syria, the participation in the no war but no peace with Iran, the participation in the attacks on the poorest people in the region in Yemen have all been a shameful mark on the British record, which, as I say, has many centuries of such marks.
What does the public feel was actually achieved by the UK's military action in and around the Middle East over the last 20 years?
Well, we haven't achieved anything. So my husband was out there, fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're now looking at, we're going back again, so we haven't achieved anything. It's done full circle. So we haven't got anywhere. It hasn't done anything.
They just continue to disrupt it. That's all the intention is. I'm not particularly very happy with the way that we kind of manage ourselves and what we've done in the Middle East. It's not very good.
Nothing at all. Like I said, I've never heard any good come out of it. We're going, keep going back and spending all this money. I don't know on what at all. So nothing at all.
You should ask my son, who studied GCSE. You know, he was taught, this is what he studied, which was the Middle East, and you know, from you know, Ben Gurion and all the setting up of that. To be honest, it seems to be it's dominated by the American politics, not necessarily British politics, but by supporting, I suppose, Americans. The British are seen as being complicit in terms of what they're doing. What do I think? As I said, there are sides to both. There are both sides in terms of what there are. You know,
the Middle East hasn't moved on a whole lot in the last 20 years. But the UK has been involved for 800 years in many different places. It depends on, as I said, the purpose. If you're not seeing any improvements, you have to question why you're there.
If I think back, we have never been involved anywhere in the Middle East that hasn't been a disaster. I mean, I grew up really worried that one day I'd have to join the army and I'd be sent. I grew up really worried that I'd be forced into the army. I'd end up in a war somewhere in the Middle East. And the simple fact is that literally all this has been about the control of oil, not about democracy or defending people's rights. We have been responsible, along with America. We've been the number two in this. America's been the main lead in all this. And hundreds of thousands of people have died because of it. And we've ended up with a legacy of really unpleasant dictatorial regimes. Where in the Middle East have we created a nice democracy? We haven't.
Well, nothing good has been achieved for Britain, that's for sure. The demonstration that I talked about, which is a demonstration of the United States' fading power rather than growing power, has pushed people together, for example, that might not otherwise have ended up together. It's pushed Russia and China together, almost as one country, economically speaking, currency-wise, militarily. It has, in strategic politics, it has pushed China and Russia together, making a very powerful adversary indeed. It has emboldened fanatic Takfiri extremism all over the world, including in our own country. I've just been reading the inquest details of the Takfiri murderer who went wild in a street I used to live in, a man who had been in maximum security from the age of 16 and by the age of 20 was dead, but having stabbed multiple innocent people in between those two dates. It has, of course, created a new bloc in the world, which involves Iran, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on, which will not be in the United States' imperial interest to have done.
The UK is a pivotal part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that's NATO. But with all this military activity, when it comes to keeping the British public safe, has the UK's involvement in NATO done more harm than good?
To be honest, I just think we're in it because we're Britain, and that's it. We have to be part of it. I don't think we achieve anything from it. It's just to say that we're involved in it, but America will just do whatever they can for themselves, I think.
It's hard to say. I mean, you look at the July attack, you look at 2000, obviously, in the US, and you look at lots of the terrorist attacks. Where does it come from? Where does it boil down to? And it's, you know, individuals, again, making that decision based on perhaps an ideology, their own personal views, and they go and act. So would a government decision or would a treaty like the NATO treaty prevent that? I don't know. And when it was set up, it was a great idea. And I appreciate what it can help with, but does it go far enough? Are these people that are sitting around talking about these situations and then putting actions in place, is it going far enough to really drive into the root cause of these individuals that are acting?
I believe they should. I mean, every country should have the have a freedom to equip themselves, but as long as it's been used for surveilling the borders, yeah, not for sort of putting pressure on other countries. Yeah. So yes, every country has the right to sort of equip themselves with whatever weapons and whatever things they need to do to secure their boundaries. So I have no problem with that. Yeah.
If anything, we seem to be going in the opposite direction in the last 10 years. Maybe in the early years there was some improvements, but it's definitely stoked fires, not just the UK, everybody's involvement, because there's different purposes for you being there. And in short, no, in the recent years, it's probably getting worse. And that's because any time you step into somebody's territory and use certain tactics, you're going to upset people. You don't have to go too far. You can come back locally and realize that if you continue with the same policies that don't seem to be working, you're going to upset people, and people will start to turn around and see what they can do. And if there isn't another power, another government that can support them, they'll start to take on that pressure themselves and revolt.
Basically, when NATO was set up just after the end of the Second World War, we were being told we were under a threat from the Soviet Union, Russia, And we now know, given all the data has been released, there was never a threat. Stalin had no intention of attacking the West. This was all about creating this military complex that we controlled Europe, not the Soviet Union. And the simple fact is people should have been allowed to create their own governments in their own time. We were involved in so many wars throughout all my life. It's been every single one of them. It's been not about democracy. It's been about economic interests.
Britain's involvement in NATO is an extremely expensive way of defending ourselves, even though we, in fact, have no discernible enemies that could attack us beyond the very Takfiri extremist terrorists that we have been doing so much to help in places like Libya, in places like Syria. NATO is no defense at all against a man with a samurai sword in a park going around cutting people's heads off. Britain has no nuclear enemy and no country, no state, which is conceivably going to pose a risk to British security. So we're paying a lot of money and paying a high political price for being involved with, you call it NATO, but it's really just the United States' gang, you know, and it would be quickly dispensed with if other NATO countries began to oppose American adventurism in Latin America, for example. Not many people know that that well-known North Atlantic power, Colombia, is currently a candidate member for NATO. But if any country or group of countries began to oppose NATO's involvements in different parts of the world, it would quickly be dispensed with. This is the United States' coalition of the killing.
The direct cost to America of the Afghanistan conflict is estimated at $2 trillion. In terms of death toll, in Libya, deaths are estimated at 30,000. The figure in Afghanistan is over 115,000 dead. In Yemen, the number exceeds 130,000. For Syria, those killed has passed 500,000. And for Iraq, it exceeds 600,000. Thus, the total official estimate of dead in these five countries alone is 1.375 million. This is almost certainly an underestimate.
After 20 years of war in Afghanistan and elsewhere, does the public think the UK will choose a more peaceful approach in the future, or will the next 20 years just be more of the same?
Not really. I have a cousin who works in the army in Israel, and it looks like it's something that's going to keep going on forever. There's always some sort of massive thing breaking out, and loads of people are dying and feeling terrified. So, I don't know.
When you go into a country to make things better, but have a backdoor deal to sell arms, and that may not be directly, maybe indirectly going back to that source country as well, you have to question it.
I don't think so. Human nature, you know, we have this territorial kind of ideology, or I don't know. I guess it's a person's survival of the fittest. Sorry, the Darwin's theory. And we group together, and we want to have our own sort of space. And I think we should educate ourselves a bit better. We should help each other, support each other, and hopefully bring about change within ourselves in order to impact the environment, the community that we live in. And we'll be living in a better place, but I don't know if we'll ever remove conflict, because that's just human nature.
More the same. I can't see this ending. I can't see how this is actually going to end. Like I said, I think it's just going to constantly just go round in circles. There is just no end to this, is there? Now we've started it, how do you end a war once you've started a war? There is no end, is there? It's tit for tat. It's just going to keep going round and round.
Well, it's quite clear. Now that America's decided to pull out, we've decided to pull out, it's going to be up to the people in Afghanistan. The trouble is, I'm not a supporter of the Taliban, of course. I mean, and imposing a religion on people is wrong. I want to live in a world where everyone is free to live their life as they choose, not to be told you've got to support this religion, that religion, live this or that life. Just let people be themselves.
Unfortunately, I think the next 20 years will be very much like the last 20 years. Beyond 20, no one could safely hazard a guess. But we are locked into this alliance with the United States. The United States is fading, but still dangerous. Even the broken teeth of an old tiger can bite. And as long as we're locked into being the tail of that old tiger, I'm afraid we'll have to follow the head.
The UK is the second biggest arms dealer in the Middle East behind America. How will British arms exports be affected following the global economic problems caused by COVID? And is Britain even more dependent on the arms trade now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. There's a lot of decisions that are driven by, and there's a lot of things that come out of that. Stopping that, would it prevent the wars that are happening? And would it prevent some of the issues that are in these countries, in Middle East, in Afghanistan, in other countries? I don't know. But certainly, again, the government needs to be taken to account for those actions and those trades and transactions. I understand that we're an economy. I understand that the life situation here is better. You know, if I was in Afghanistan and I'd grown up in Afghanistan, the education that I would have had would mean nothing compared to what I have had living in the UK. And I'm very grateful for that. But again, it needs to be taken into account and it needs to be challenged, and we need to talk about it more and be more aware of it moving forward.
Well, I think probably it's going to mean that more countries seem to be more worried about it themselves, because they've got to look after what's happening in their own countries. So they're maybe not looking and keeping an eye on what's going abroad very much, because the pandemic causes huge issues in your own country.
I hope not. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I definitely hope that people will realise that it's not the way forward. But yeah, like I said, I don't really know much about it. But I don't think that it's a productive use of forces and money.
Well, we're not financially reliant. It's quite small as a proportion of our national economy. But the simple fact is, if you look at this, half of all the military spending in the world is by the United States of America. I mean, literally, every other country in the world together just equals what America spends on its military. And the tragedy is, all throughout most of my life, British governments, Labour or Conservative, have just been going along with what America wants. Fortunately, for my generation, the then Labour government, Harold Wilson, refused to get involved in the war in Vietnam. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interviewing me now. I'd be dead.
Well, where there's muck, there's brass, we say in this country. Where there are dirty things, there's money to be made. In this case, where there's brass in the form of arms exports, there's muck to be gathered. And the muck may be lucre, but it's filthy lucre. And I don't expect that to change. It's a symptom of Britain's industrial and manufacturing decline that just about the best things that we make nowadays are weapons. Weapons which, in the end, pierce the skin and the heads of overwhelmingly innocent people. A man's just gone to prison in the United States of America for 4 years for exposing the fact that drones, the kind of drones we routinely make and routinely sell and see you routinely used, kill 90% innocent civilians. There's blood on the hands of Britain's weapons manufacturers, but they're not going to stop or go out of business anytime soon.
Since 2001, the UK has backed conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Britain is also the second largest arms exporter to the Middle East. Britain has therefore made literally billions of pounds worth of business
through the sale and use of weapons in these countries and beyond.
Twenty years and countless deaths later, with the Taliban once again advancing in Afghanistan and the region in conflict, Britain has made a fortune out of war, but at the cost of lives and peace. The UK could change course tomorrow, but some suggest that for Britain PLC, war is just too profitable to let peace get in the way.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini, Some Discipline and Secrets of Takbirs, and the Eradication of Hands. There is a reference to some of what has been said in a lengthy tradition, quoting Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon him, describing the ascending. He said, Allah the Glorified and Almighty sent down to the Prophet a carriage of light comprised of 40 sorts of light which were around the heaven of Allah, blessed and most high, blurs the eyes of the onlookers. One of them was yellow, and it became the cause of the yellowness of the yellow. Another one was red, and it became the cause of the redness of the red. Then he added, he, the messenger, sat in it, and it ascended him to the lower heaven. The angels ran to the outskirts of the heaven, and then they fell in prostration and said, "All glorified and all holy is our Lord, the Lord of the angels and the Spirit. How this light is like the light of our Lord." Jibreel said, "God is great."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, in one of his speeches, he mentions that Islam accepts material things that are subservient to spiritualities. In another speech, he mentions that Islam provides inner training as well as preserve material welfare. Now, this is very important. Generally, when we talk about Islam, when it is said to follow the Quran or the teachings of Islam, generally people think that we should not follow what has been put for us in this material world. Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum. You know, today in the West, we have a new discussion, and it is said that you are what you eat. Now, this concept is very much clear for our listeners, inshallah, in the West, that in the TV, especially like if you look at the TV nowadays, they are saying, you are what you eat. Islam has forbidden some animals. Why? Because you are what you eat. Islam has allowed us to eat some of the animals which are halal meat and with a specific method because you are what you eat. Islam has forbidden from some actions, performing some actions because you are what you do. And he has allowed us to do some actions because you are what you do. Therefore, there are the proper ways, the halal ways of doing some actions. There are some halal ways to enjoy in this world. And if you do it through its way, then you will definitely enjoy the next world as well, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.